I'm Christopher Lydon in Bangalore, the information technology capital of the new India. I'm sitting with a very Indian family nest of social networkers and entrepreneurs. Their business would be classified design, but it's not so much logos and letterheads or retail display. It's really about contours of markets and the flow of essential commerce in India and far beyond it. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is with a family, mama, papa, 19-year-old son just home from Stanford University in California, who are out on the frontier of digital India together. Neelam Chibber, what does it say about India or about you that you're all in this game as a family?
This is very interesting, Chris, because I feel one of the key distinctions that Indian society has vis-a-vis maybe the US and China is the strength of the family. And that maybe because we are still not one-child families, I think the Chinese have lost a lot with that one-child policy. They may have done a great thing for the planet by having fewer people around, but it's not good for society. Because I believe that a lot of thinking can never be for the short term. I think a lot of the problems with your financial problems in the US is it's about short-term thinking. That you're thinking just for the next 2 years or 3 years or to your next bonus. Now, that kind of thinking is cultivated because as a society, maybe thoughts of longevity and long-term are lost. But when you have a family system, you think ahead constantly. You're planning for your children and your grandchildren. And you are planning for your parents. I think as a family, we grew a lot because we looked after elderly parents. And our parents looked after their parents. I think that's going to be one of the key strengths of India in the future. Because I think that is what is incubating better thinking and more holistic thinking.
Can I make a note that in your house it's been a great pleasure to eat your mother's food and to say evening prayers with Jacob's mother?
Yes. See, these are all the important things about us being, that him being a Christian and me being a Hindu and all about that. So yeah, it's not always easy. It is difficult. But his parents were opposed to the idea that why do you want to marry a Hindu? Because we arranged our marriage. Ours was not a love marriage, right? We were classmates and we never had an affair when we were in college. But after we graduated, we were looking for husbands and wives. Our parents were. And then we said, we know each other, so why don't we get married? So his mother said, look, you're arranging your marriage. Why don't you just arrange it with a Christian? Why have you chosen a Hindu? So he said, well, she's my friend. She happens to be Hindu, so let's not worry about it. But, and then they adjusted. But a lot of the adjustment happened because both the families adjusted. Now, how did both the families adjust? Because they had a history of families which adjusted. So a lot of future negotiations and things that happen on the planet and when you work in global teams is going to be all about how you adjust with everybody else. So first of all, you start adjusting in a family of four. Like my two sons find it very difficult to adjust with each other. But they're learning. You know, so that's how you learn when you grow up. So the whole family thing is key, yeah.
Would you begin, just tell us your story as a businesswoman, maybe as a mother too, as an educator, as a networker, an entrepreneur and a friend of entrepreneurs?
That's a big, big question. But I'll just start very simply. India is a very difficult country to live in, purely because of the contrasts in incomes. We are constantly surrounded. We are well off. We are from a middle class. I would say now I'm upper middle class. But throughout our childhood, we were always surrounded by poorer people. And I'm sure every thinking Indian thinks about it. And India as a society is one where because we have people serving us, we have servants, we have drivers. And sometimes what we spend in a meal is what our driver earns for the month. So any thinking, questioning Indian thinks about these things. And it was very clear to me from an early age that one would just have to do something about it. That was all. So one just did school. And then when the time came to go to college, I could have become a doctor. I could have become an architect. But I didn't. I chose design simply because the prospectus of our design school said that design solves problems. And it said you can design anything from a safety pin to a highway. It sounds a little cliched now, but then it sounded very interesting. So we went to design school, and I think further our education molded us. My husband and I both are from the same design school. We're from the same class. And design school just enabled us with the tools to look at a problem and try to come up with a solution. It was simple. I mean, these were the tools we were provided with.
Who told you what the problem was?
We could see it. It was all around us.
Define it.
It's inequities. The problem in India is the inequity. Like if, again, today the buzzword with the Indian government constantly is inclusive growth. How does the growing 30% urban population take along its 70% rural poor population? And how will it do it without the Chinese Revolution? How will it do it without the Russian Revolution? How will it do it in a peaceful way? So I started a company. When I was just in my last year in design school, I went and worked. I'm trained as an industrial designer. I'm a product designer. And I didn't want to go and work in industry and design toasters and stuff. So in our design school, there was a culture of working with crafts, working with the rural artisanal sector. So I went and worked in a deep, remote tribal pocket of India, which is now run over by the Maoists. Hmm. And I worked with tribal craftsmen.
What were they making?
They were doing lost wax metal casting. It's the oldest form of metal casting. The Incas, the Aztecs, everybody did this. And it's amazing when you live with them, when you work with them, you see the phenomenal amount of skill they have and how something is being preserved across the centuries. But nobody is really recognizing the importance of this. And India has maybe more than 40 million such artisans. Pre-industrial revolution, India was a completely self-sufficient society. In all our villages, we made whatever we consumed. Post-industrial revolution, you have urban factories sending goods to rural economies. So the rural artisans are unemployed, So which is leading to a whole lot of urban migration. It's leading to a lot of poverty. At the same time, rural artisans, because one of the reasons I worked in this tribal area was to really try to understand this from scratch. So I moved into the most untouched area and I would go with them to their village markets. So a village artisan sits down in a village market and his consumer walks past him, the villager, and then he comes and talks to him. So either he's cast a set of anklets, or he's cast some jewelry, or he's cast a votive horse, or he's cast a little idol, or he's cast a utensil, or he's cast a tobacco holder. You know, so they made everything which was bought by somebody in their village or from the next village. And then he was always in touch with his consumer. So the consumer would tell him, oh, it's too expensive, or oh, I want it like this, or I want the shape changed. And these guys evolved with their consumers over the years, right? Over the centuries. But now their customers have been taken away by cheaper products, mass-produced products. And so these guys don't have access to another set of consumers, which are us urban consumers, right? India has a huge growing retail economy. We are supposed to be one of the fastest growing organized retail players in the world right now. And we are importing container loads of daily artifacts and decor and lifestyle merchandise from other countries because there are huge vacuums in the supply chain. So over the year, by forming up my company, it's called Industry. That's Indus is India and tree is like the tree. That's a name given by my husband for the company. So we formed a for-profit, right? Way back in 1994, saying that, okay, let's design new products with all these artisans and let's retail them in urban markets. So let us be the link between urban rural producers and urban customers. That was the mandate of the company. That if these guys cannot really sit across the road with their customers in the local village market, let us be that connect.
Sounds as if you're trying to promote an old-fashioned production or modernize old production more than build a modern consumer demand. Am I right?
We are not building modern consumer demand. All we are trying to tell Indian consumers is that try to think about what you buy. Check where is this coming from. Is it good for the environment? And who's made it? And it's not something we can do overnight. But we are trying to create an awareness in the Indian consumer saying that, look, if this is made in a village by producers and they are earning well from it, would you prefer to buy this? Or would you prefer to buy something from some other country where you don't know who has been paid how much for it?
China, for example.
For example. Yes.
We're not talking religious trinkets either, or bric-a-brac.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the most horrific, I would say, symptoms in this area, that for years everybody has treated traditional livelihoods and artisanal livelihood as something linked to culture. We view it differently. We say, fine, it is linked to culture, but for the future, it's totally, totally linked to livelihoods. That these people can earn well producing good stuff made for contemporary living. If you just give them some amount of market information. And I say this with a strong belief because I have worked with artisans so closely that artisans over the centuries always evolved for the needs of the consumer. So if now they evolve to making a bookcase for you and it's not a cultural product, it's fine. It's perfect.
Can I ask a silly shorthand question? Mm. Is this the old India or the new India that you're working?
The new India. We are working completely with the new India. They have old skills, but they are new Indians. They are not old Indians. They watch modern television. They wear modern clothes. They are new Indians. They all aspire. They want their kids to be educated. No artisan wants his child to continue being an artisan unless it becomes new. So they don't say we want our kids to become IT professionals. They say, yeah, we'd love our kid to continue being a lost wax metal artisan, provided you have moved him into the 20th century or the 21st century with his skill. And that is possible.
Jacob Matthew, you're the husband in this team. Just for starters, when did the idea of a new India and a new economy and a new opportunity to maybe show the world a trick or two, when did this occur to you?
Well, for me, I think it was about 25 years ago in my final year in college. And I had done my final project in studying small enterprises. So I went around visiting a lot of small producers. And the kind of energy and the, shall we say, the hunger to do things within very sort of limited resources sort of fired my imagination. I was also, I think at that point, influenced by people like Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful. So it all sort of fitted in, and I kind of had a sense of what I wanted to do, which is how to work with small scale industry and use that energy and enterprise to sort of progress. And there was no need for small scale industry to remain primitive just because of scale. So in a sense, that's what I've been doing since.
You have a big design team. Big by my standards, but I'm still getting my head around what you mean by design. And does it have a capital D or a little D?
We believe it has a small D. Designers with a big D, I would look at Newsom and Zaha Hadid and people like that, you know, who are sort of star designers. And then there are the designers with the small D. You never hear their names, but they are the people that you interact with or whose products or whose services that you interact with on a day-to-day basis. If you look at it another way and look at how important design is in the scheme of things, yes, it has a big, huge D. But it's not linked to a personality or to an individual, but it's linked to the whole activity.
What's the designer's stamp?
One is how you connect to the consumer, how you convey the culture of the company within the company itself, so that everybody is sort of aimed towards a common goal. How the company is perceived in the larger world of consumers, of investors, of what you would call the larger world of stakeholders, and how you design a business and multiple businesses within that business.
Jacob, who are you competing with? in India, but I'm thinking especially for ideas, branding, expertise of Europe, the United States, and very especially about China. China, we know, is the world's great manufacturer now. Will that ever be a playing field for Indian producers?
Well, Indian service providers are already in China. You have NIIT, which is the National Institute of Information Technology, which is really the engine that developed all the software programmers in India. They have offices now, and they're training people in China. So you will see Indian enterprises working out of China. You have Chinese enterprises working out of India. But I think one big difference between the way China works and India works is, one, because of democratic concerns, we work a little slower. And in many ways, it's a lot better. So we did a project which was like, you know, one-fifth of the Three Gorges project in India, the Narmada Dam. But China went ahead and made this huge, monstrous dam thing, which wouldn't have been so easy to do in India. India also does these kind of, engineering follies. But it's a little more difficult to do it without public outrage and, you know, at least some response to what the public thinks about it. The other is that China very often decides on a policy and then steamrolls that policy ahead. So China has decided that it has to be part of the knowledge economy. It has to be part of the design and creative economy. So they have started on a program to, shall we say, mass-produce designers. India has currently about 6,000 designers for almost 1.2 billion people. The need is actually for about 150,000 to 250,000 designers in India. China is currently producing something like 50,000 designers a year, whereas we are still producing a few thousand. But the quality of the designers that China is producing is a little suspect. But at the same time, the fact that the government is taking an interest in it, they actually have a product design fair, a trade fair, completely focused on product design in China. That's the only place in the world where there's a product design trade fair. Mm. So, I mean, when the government takes an interest like this, it's the numbers that they produce can be extremely interesting. What would need to be seen is the quality that they're producing. And I think we have a lot to learn from them in terms of policy. They have a lot to learn from us in terms of perhaps caution.
Everybody credits India for its engineering, for information technology, for computing, every kind of computing technology and service. How do you define your piece of the new India outside the giant enterprises? What is the new India for you?
Well, the new India is, we'll have to find our own way through this, through the mess that we are in globally. And so that's where enterprises like Neelam's, which is a sustainable enterprise, which brings consumption into the conscious stream, as we call it, very important, which is being aware of what you're doing, what your needs are, how do you fulfill those needs, what is the impact those needs have on the planet as a whole, how sustainable is it? Because if we start consuming, if we, that is India and China, start consuming like the United States or Western Europe, you'll need four or five planets to sustain the consumption. And that is not an option. So I think a lot of the solutions for the future are going to come out of this part of the world in terms of how we do more with less and have less of a footprint. So I think there is a huge amount of work which is happening in India across organizations. These are not united, but they're sort of spontaneously happening across the country. And I would say across the world also, because, I mean, I've seen so many initiatives like this happening in California, for example. It's interesting because in my student days, I was actually very influenced by a Californian publication called the Whole Earth Review and the Whole Earth Catalog.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So they were, in a sense, our heroes. And their heroes were also our heroes. Their heroes were people like Mahatma Gandhi and so on. So it's an interesting sort of circle. So it's
what I'd like to say is, even as regards social enterprise and what I do, I mean, I have been able to do this and scale this completely based on American thought, right? Silicon Valley is now supposed to be the cradle of social enterprise.
Define social enterprise while we're at it.
Now, social enterprise is a for-profit enterprise which tries to make profit and do social good. The other very important definition of social enterprise vis-a-vis non-profits is that the people and the professionals working in the social enterprise get paid reasonably well. So unless you get good talent into social enterprise and into social business, you are not going to achieve any change.
Mm.
One of the key differences of social enterprise as a for-profit business trying to do good versus a non-profit is that non-profits often move in the directions where their grants are going. But when you set up a business, then you focus it and grow it in a direction with investment, and you have continuity, which is really key to growth.
Hmm. I think one of the definitions of social enterprise is also how you treat your stakeholders, and it's a larger stakeholder group. So typically, for-profit businesses and conventional businesses, their primary stakeholder is the shareholder. And you're always talking about maximizing shareholder value, and which I think is, in a sense, where capitalism, in a sense, went wrong, because they were only considering one stakeholder out of many. So your consumers are equally stakeholders. You never shortchange your consumers. You don't poison your consumers. You don't kill your consumers. You look at the people who work for you. So you don't shift your production to another country or another state just because it's cheaper for you to do that. You will figure out ways in which you will honor your stakeholders' needs. And your employees are very much a part of the stakeholder needs. The environment, the planet that you live on, is also a stakeholder. So how do you honor your commitment to the planet?
Mm.
And there are examples of, say, ethical businesses, the Tata Group in India, for example. They come to mind as a company that's pretty fair to its stakeholders, but they're not a social enterprise in that sense. But coming back to social enterprises and how this is measured, I mean, today you have social audits, you have environmental audits, and you have audits which are other than financial audits. And I think increasingly social enterprises are going to show the way to conventional enterprises, that there are more ways of measuring one's impact than just financial impact. And this is something that's just beginning to happen.
Nishant, speak for the future. Your dad talks about India setting an example of doing more with less. Both your parents are talking about social enterprise, multiple shareholders, the environment, the whole social system. How much of that assignment do you take on your broad shoulders at 19? And what in the world are you learning about it at Stanford?
I think I'd like to start with my experience at Stanford, because I think it's just buzzing. Stanford is, it's a center of innovation. It's always been on the cutting edge. We've had both Google and Yahoo and Silicon Valley just churned out of Stanford. So anything that's been new and interesting and cutting edge has sort of just spilled out of there. And it's sort of really taken on the social innovation thing in a very interesting way. So for example, some of the projects, there's actually a group of Stanford students who went out to set up a company called D-Light, which now supplies solar-powered lanterns to villages all over sub-Saharan Africa, to villages in India, LED lamps which are powered on solar energy. So students can study at night in villages where there's no electrification. Another example is there's some people are working on something called SMS Medic, where I think Zambia, or I'm not sure where, but in parts of Africa, they actually have doctors consulting patients via SMS, because patients don't have to travel all the way to go visit the village doctor. And there's also work being done on how to give farmers inputs on the market prices of crops via SMS again. Because in India, a lot of people have phones, right, in the middle of nowhere. So instead of traveling to the market with a bunch of crops which don't sell for very much, you can sort of figure out which crops you want to sell in the market, get some market information. So there's lots of groups and excitement and energy and projects buzzing with this whole concept of social innovation. And I think it's very interesting. So even my peers from the school I went to, a lot of them have gone abroad to universities like Cambridge, Oxford, Yale, Stanford. They're all picking up these amazing skills. They get to network with people from across the globe who are working on similar issues. And a lot of them want to come back home and work on these ideas. So I see almost like this army of people getting really intelligent educations and coming back and applying their skills to solve real pressing problems. My interest in all of this started when I used to travel with my mother. In the summers, we used to go visit her production units in rural areas. And I saw some of the poverty, and I also saw the ambition that people in rural areas had, the intelligence they had, you know, where they were willing, if they were given the opportunity, to sort of make a difference in their lives.
What kinds of places, what kind of artisans are you talking about?
We actually traveled to Tamil Nadu a lot, the southern part of Tamil Nadu. There's a village called Veer Vanalur, where there's a production facility there. And it's very interesting. It's a small, small village, and they sort of, they weave grass mats. And there's a women's self-help group that was set up there. It's very interesting. So in the ninth grade, I actually started working with a self-help group on the borders of my state, Karnataka, in a place called Krishnagiri. So me and one of my classmates, we were always interested in environmental issues and social issues. And we said, look, we have so many resources. We've got an excellent school. We've got an excellent education. And a lot of parents, a lot of the students in my school, because it's an elite institution here, a lot of their parents own some of the biggest businesses in India, some of the biggest construction firms. So they have a huge amount of influence, and their children can also influence their parents. So said, here we've got a bunch of young people who are the new face of India, whose parents are running some of the biggest institutions in this country. Let's try and do something. So we tried to start a movement with the youth in our school. It's just, we started there. So then we tried to get eco bags, cloth bags produced at this self-help group, which we sold in supermarkets to try and replace plastic bags. We started a number of environmental campaigns. We basically wanted to tell the youth that, you know, it's easy to get empowered. And once you figure out how exciting it is to create new enterprises, to sort of make a real difference in rural areas, to sort of use your intelligence and be creative and innovative every day, try and turn your attention to these problems, it gives you back so much more than just, like, say, working at an investment bank, right?
If I can interrupt, you're speaking of investment for impact, management, design for impact, as opposed to profit. Who's going to make those impacts as attractive as, you know, multi-million dollar bonuses?
So I think the major transformation that happened, for example, back in the day, like 15 years ago, the only way you could make a difference is by joining an NGO, right? Or joining UNICEF, or joining like a UN-sponsored program where you sort of throw aid at people. So I think one of the major transformations has been the social enterprise, where you can make a profit, you can run it like a business, because NGOs do great work, but they lack that sort of business sensibilities to be self-sustainable. NGOs sometimes function off of grants. And as we spoke about grants, they go wherever the fame is, whatever's popular. People sort of give grants to whatever's popular at the time. At the end of the day, I'm really interested in entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship as an entity means it's sort of a craft where you're constantly innovating. You're constantly networking. You're constantly growing new ideas. Unlike an NGO, which sometimes has a fixed way of functioning. So I think it's much more appealing now to work at for a social entrepreneurship than it is for an NGO. Because it's got a sense, it's almost like a Silicon Valley startup in a sense. The same ethos, the same culture. Why do people who start up Silicon Valley? Why did Bill Gates go and set up Microsoft? Why did Steve Jobs go and set up Apple? Because it's exciting. You're taking an idea, your brainchild, and you're growing it.
But isn't it true that the great Indian enterprises, including Infosys, going back to Tata too, as well as Microsoft and Silicon Valley, but are driven by a bottom line in the end, by a profit and by accumulation of vast wealth.
Yeah,
is that not the rule for most of the young drivers in India, or not?
I think yes. Vast sums of money is that rainbow in the distance, but it's also about that, just the excitement of starting something new, starting a brainchild. And again, I spoke about shifts in cultural values. So a lot of my peers at Stanford don't really want to become filthy rich with $3 billion parachutes, right? At the end of the day, if they get to do something they love, and if they get to make a livelihood out of it, but if they have that sort of impact on the world, it makes up for. So it's an interesting, it's how do we work with this new culture?
Draw the clearest contrast you can with what you're doing in India and at Stanford, and with what you might do or couldn't do in China. What's the difference in those models of profit, non-profit, the sharing of responsibilities and of benefits, social and individual? What's the diff?
China is very interesting because it's hard for me to imagine what China is like, actually, because it's such a different culture. Me and my friends, we talk about, I have a couple of Chinese friends in Stanford, but it's interesting because the Chinese model, even though they have a market system, the even the how nationalist they are. For example, the Indians who are at Stanford, we have no problem dissing our government. We scream on, we go on about corruption, about poverty, inequality. But whenever we talk to some of our Chinese friends, they always are very, very either patriotic. They find it very hard to say anything bad about China. And it's not because they're afraid. It's because it's what they really inherently believe. So it's very interesting to view the cultural differences. Like, I've never traveled to China, but my only exposure to the Chinese has been at Stanford. You know, we actually have a lot of Chinese freshmen. And it's interesting to see they're very sort of nationalistic in a sense. You know, they're very proud of what China has accomplished. And they're not as critical of China as we are of India, which I found a very interesting cultural difference.
Good or bad for your future?
I think really good for India's future, because I think it's very important for the people of a nation to constantly be questioning the government, to constantly be questioning, is this the way things should be run? Are we doing what's right for the nation? You know, it's really important to have that discourse, that dialogue, and to be critical of what's happening around you.
Nishad, it occurs to me, you are the new India in the sense that you were born in 91 when India made the great step toward an open capitalist development. How do you define the prospects, and how do you define the new India to begin with?
Okay, it's interesting, because I see India sort of between two forces, the old India and the new India, because I see a lot of conservatism in the way we think, especially in the middle classes. We still have huge issues with the caste system, even though it might not be as evident. We still have a lot of things holding us back. And I think one of the most interesting things for me is education, because I received a very, very progressive education, but it's not what the majority of children in India receive. A majority of children in India, for example, getting into an IIT, we spoke about IIT. The only way you get into an IIT is through one standardized entrance test. That's all. And that test even dictates what you're allowed to study at IIT. You need to get above a certain rank to study the most prized subjects like computer engineering. So in that system, people are trained to think very linearly, to train to study only for the test. Now, that kills any sort of creativity. It kills that sort of critical thinking, those skills that are vital. I mean, if you've been trained all your life to just get into this one college and then this desperate struggle to just fend for your own family and sort of build your own career, then how can you think about the larger issues, you know? But if, for example, you were trained like we, our school always, at every step of the way, would instruct us to think about the larger issues, to sort of really step back and think for ourselves, most importantly.
Issues being
social inequality, spread of AIDS, to see how is India going to compete in a global market, you know?
Environment too?
And huge emphasis on the environment, huge emphasis on climate change, huge emphasis on sustainability. And what was very interesting, the school always tried to foster individual projects. Individual initiative by students, what was most highly prized. So I think if India really wants to progress, it needs a population that is willing to think flexibly, to think across disciplines, to think about larger issues. And how do you get that done? By having an education that trains you to think intelligently and think inclusively.
What's the difference with the Chinese students you're working with in California?
For one, every single one of them knows how to play an instrument. None of us Indian, we play guitar every now and then, but they're all classically trained pianists or something. Oh, for example, the main difference I see is a lot of them are highly specialized in something. They're either extremely good at mathematics or extremely good at computer science, but they're to some extent one-dimensional. They are brilliant mathematicians or brilliant CS students. I mean, they just top all the Stanford classes, put the seniors to shame, but that's about it. It's interesting. They don't, and most of the Indian students who get in there all come from international schools, and they have more like a really broad, they're slightly broader in their interests. They sort of are clued into the global scene. It's very interesting to see those differences. So I would say the main thing I've noticed about of the freshmen Chinese students is they're very focused. It's just interesting. They've come there to get a world class, either a CS training or an engineering training, and then go back to China. And they all want to go back and start up. Every single one of them wants to go back to China. No one wants to stay in America. They all say that the opportunities in China, they want to go up and they want to set up their companies.
Are they burdened by their past, as you say the Indian students are, by their culture, by their training,
yeah,
by their habits, or not?
I think to some extent, less so, because they're I think China did away with some of its cultural background, historical background, in order to progress ahead. So I say it would also fit to how focused they are. You know, they really know what they come to Stanford to do, and they really want to get like a good degree and go back. And they see a lot of opportunity. They're always very forward-looking. So I don't think they look back on their past that much. They're really focused and forward-looking, which is interesting because I believe an education needs to be open. Again, even at a place like Stanford, I see a lot of students who come in wanting to be CS students and can get through an entire 4 years doing nothing but CS, which to me is criminal because I think in order to solve some of the pressing world challenges, a good engineer, a CS engineer to me, is someone who understands anthropology or human behavior, which was Google did. Google created brilliant user interface. Its genius was in its simplicity. Of course, the algorithms were part of it. The CS was part of it. But it had this really open-minded view, which is what I think design education brings in. This really broad perspective, you know, where you get inspiration, innovation, creativity from a number of sources.
Can I ask, will the Matthew family ever work all together? Where will you be in 2020, 2030, 2040?
I think it's interesting that the Matthew family does work all together in many instances. We always are in dialogue. I spent my childhood growing up in either my father's office or my mother's office, just tailing them around to every single meeting they went to, every single interesting person they met, every single bit of business they were doing. I was always with them. Even when I'm in Stanford, I sometimes keep Skype open and listen in on their conversations. So, and both of them can't work together directly because they'll end up killing each other, but they always consult each other when they get home, you know. They share ideas, share contacts. So it's interesting to see. It's a very, and I think it's also part of my growing up, my upbringing, was being in such close contact with what my parents did. For example, a lot of my classmates, if I ask them what their parents do, they're like, something to do with law, some sort of business thing. And I'm like, that's criminal. I mean in a wild, a baby tiger cub learns how to hunt with his parent, follows it to work, essentially. So I view it much the same way. Yeah.
Papa, where will we be in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years?
Actually, I would like to answer it slightly differently. You were asking about, you know, when you work in social enterprise, how do you get people to work in social enterprise and not want to hanker after those, you know, those $1 million bonuses that you would get in Goldman Sachs? I think there is a possibility. There is a sort of a middle way, which is what I'm working on and what I hope Nishant will probably be interested in working on later as well. So I'm in the process of setting up what I call a Design for Social Change Venture Fund. And we believe that design, business strategy and capital coming together for the social sector, which will actually give you better returns than most tech-focused venture funds have been returning in the U.S. So we believe that Design for Social Change Venture Fund will give a return of 5x to 9x over a period of 7 years, which would be actually in the top drawer of venture funds. And it's because you get complete commitment from your stakeholders. You get a strong sense of who you're working for. So in terms of your stakeholders being a social business, you bring in a great sense of economy and, say, lightness from design. And you bring in the capital that is otherwise very difficult to access. And we think that there is a pot of gold for the investors, but not maybe the Goldman Sachs kind of or whatever the conventional financial markets have been.
Have you figured out a way to quantify that social impact, the public return? Does it matter? Do you have to?
No, we think that one of the criteria that we're laying out for possible investees is that they undertake to use metrics other than just financial. So they would have to undergo social audits, they would have to undergo environmental audits, they would have to undergo stakeholder audits to see how they have behaved with their stakeholders. So it's really bringing in a much broader perspective on metrics, on measurements, and maybe do away with a lot of the silly measurements. Because, I mean, like if you look at India, I mean, this is India specific, if you look at how Indians operate. We hate measurement. We hate measurement of any sort. Nishant's just picked up a poster which talks about Indian cooks. They never like to measure the ingredients. They just say a little bit of that and a little bit more of that. And it's sort of, we always work by approximation. So why does it have to be so precise Why do you have to spend so much of energy getting in very, very precise measurements when perhaps approximations are good enough? Because you have a broad sense of where you're going. So anyway, these would be, I think, defining characteristics of new Indian businesses.
I keep wondering, in this new India, where did that British background go? The servitude under the Brits, but also the language, the gift, the business models, all the good and bad of, 200 years of the Raj.
I think, like one of my friends pointed out, says the place where you see the British influence the most is in the system of governance. The system of governance has not changed. It was established based on the British model that was present in the time that the British left India. Britain has long since moved on. They've made very interesting innovations in how they handle the bureaucracy. The joke is bureaucracy was invented in Britain, but it was perfected and taken to the nth degree, sort of to the logical limit in India. So I think we see it the most. Culturally, not so much. I mean, of course, we do have we all speak British English. We have some cultural remnants, but I think the place where you see it the most is in our system of government. Yeah.
I think some of the things that Britain, some of the legacies that we've got from Britain is, one is probably English, which is a double-edged sword.
Because the
English language. Because while that has, in a sense, united us, it has also removed us quite a bit from our culture. So Nishant, for example, I mean, we as a family speak in English to each other. Because otherwise, I mean, I can't speak Punjabi, Neelam can't speak Malayalam, and the kids speak neither. They can speak a bit of Hindi. But our means of communication is English. But we also lose out on a lot of cultural nuances. And this is something that you will find when you read Pavan Verma, the bureaucrat's books. In my work, for example, because we deal so closely with culture, I find that a huge loss, the fact that I don't think or dream in my language, in my mother language, a huge loss, actually. Mm. Because we are missing out so much of wealth, of cultural wealth.
Mm.
Yeah? But on the other hand, English is the administrative language. It has helped us sort of, seg into the global economy much easier. The whole IT boom and the BPO boom in India is really based on our ability to speak and converse in English. So those have been advantages. And some of the things that the British did as a way of actually despoiling the country, which is building the railway system. The railway system was basically made to take away things.
Right.
It was not really meant to develop the country in a sense. But that became a major aid in developing the country, the railway system. And it is the largest single organization in the country. So there was some good. And lastly, I think what the British left behind was a fairly robust education system. Now, one can complain about maybe that it's killed creativity, but killing of creativity, I think, happened with the Industrial Revolution and not really with what the British particularly did. So how you bring back creative thinking and allow creative thinking to flourish in our education system. These are, I think, three things that we'll have to work on very hard.
I'm sure you will, too. Neelam, you had the first word. We should give you the last. This is so fascinating to me that a lot of buzzwords that we hear elsewhere, like impact investing and social enterprise, have a somewhat, I don't know, greater urgency, reality, practical meaning, as you speak about them in India. And maybe the problems of equity and environment are more urgent here than elsewhere. But I mean, can you see India kind of branding a reputation on that edge? What would it sound like? What would you have to do to claim that initiative?
India is very much on the forefront. Right now, one of the biggest proponents of social business is Muhammad Yunus. But it's a small country he's dealing with. India is vast, and a lot of effort from a lot of directions is going towards incubating social enterprise in India. And therefore, India is going to be on the forefront. There is no doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about it. Because it's going to be far more multifaceted than what's happening in Bangladesh. Because there, just one model is being repeated, but here you're going to see all kinds of models. And I think it's very important for the success of this sector that all different kinds of models are incubated, and finally the best will win, as in how they suit the varying societies. People are doing so much of this in India because it's the easiest place to do it in, because there's so much of intellectual capital. There's so much of mercantile capital, you know, and there's so much of kind of bridging capital, like our small businesses, our small... We had a meeting with Mr. Harold Rosen from the Grassroots Business Fund of the World Bank last week, with Mr. Biani, who's the head of Future Group, which is this massive business house. And so he was so happy. He said, it's great to see mainstream mercantile people like you investing in social businesses like industry, because it's actually not happened anywhere else in the world. And time itself will tell which models will succeed, the totally capitalist models or these socially capitalist models.
Thanks to the whole family. This is a wonderful introduction to New Indian Economy 101, hugely interesting, and it does apply to the United States as well as the rest of the developing world. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.